Hello, Trailblazer fans, and welcome to the Blazer's Edge podcast. You can find us on Stitcher, on iTunes, in a billion places, wherever we are. Make sure you catch us, because we love talking with you about your Portland Trailblazers. And I am Dave Deckard, the managing editor of BlazersEdge.com. With me, as always, is feature writer Dan Morang. Dan, we are entering into the dog days. We are not quite there yet. It's kind of the puppy days of the summer, soon to blossom into full-grown dog. How are you feeling right now?
Literally, I'm sitting here with a slip rib and I can barely move and breathe. So, I mean, it kind of mimics how the sports season feels right about now. It's kind of meh. Don't really want to do a whole lot. This time of year's normally kind of bleh, but at least we've got a little bit of Olympic basketball to hold us over. And right now, as we're recording this, I've got the replay of the USA men's team against China playing, and that's kind of sating the appetite a little bit. But other than that, man, is it October yet?
A slipped rib. I think I ordered one of those at Tony Roma's at one point. Olympic basketball should be interesting. We can get into that more as it progresses, provided the arena stays in one place and Rio doesn't just implode upon itself.
That's no kidding.
The stories down there. I mean, there's always pre-Olympics jitters and worries in the media, but it's near panic level at this point. So that'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But that's for another podcast. Today, actually, we're going to cover some of the things that other people are saying about the Blazers. And we've got a mixed bag of stuff from national writers. And so let's dive right into it. The first thing that we're going to look at is ESPN recently came out with a prediction that the Trailblazers will end up fourth in the Western Conference. What was that about, and how do you feel about it?
You know, the thing about it is that it could go a lot of different ways. So I wasn't really against it, and I think we've talked about it a bit. Like the range for Portland is anywhere from, you know, 4 to 8. I mean, this is just the way the West is. There's just a couple teams up top that most assuredly will probably be there. But with the way that ESPN broke it down, their win projections, everybody's really packed in there in that 4 to 8, in the 4 to 8 seed ratio, so, or seed range. So I don't think it was too outside the box with what they did. Portland won 44 games last year. They projected them to win 46 this year. So I guess they're saying, in a sense, that the seed level from 4 to 8 is going to be a little less wins than it has been in the past.
Yeah, and they're basically forecasting the Blazers as the best of the rest, which seems fair enough, because that's almost what they ended up as last year. So if you figure some marginal improvement and nobody passed them, they should end up there again. They didn't crack the San Antonio Golden State Clippers triumvirate, which you wouldn't expect them to predict, but it would be nicer to have the Blazers associated closer to that group than closer to the group that includes Dallas, Utah, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's the Blazers basically, they've moved maybe in the seeding predictions because of what the predictors are forecasting about other people, but the Blazers haven't really taken a step forward there, although fourth in the West would admittedly be pretty nice.
I mean, you're talking about home court until you get into the next seeds. That would be huge. And really, I've been pretty negative as far as the outlook for the season, as far as huge expectations. But the one thing I think people need to consider is that while Portland, I don't think, got demonstrably better, nobody around them in that range really did either.
Hey, Utah, maybe. I mean, Utah's the one that everybody's talking about, and I kind of agree. I mean, we'll pick that up. What's really funny is the teams that did get probably better are all in Portland's division, but we'll pick that up at the end of the show here. So ESPN, thumbs up, fourth in the West. That's nice. I think they're giving credit for last season, certainly, and for the couple of moves that the Blazers made this year. CBS has the Blazers more in the middle of the pack. They ranked them against the entire NBA, and they did a couple things. First of all, they gave them, I believe, a C grade for the free agent moves, average,
yep.
Not great, not bad, and said they had now the 11th best starting lineup in the league, which, of course, would be Lillard and McCollum with Turner, Aminu, and Plumlee, I believe.
Yep.
So How do you feel about those? C about the right grade, 11th best starting lineup?
The C grade seems about right. Like I said, I haven't been real high on it, but C to C plus, it wasn't spectacular, but they made moves that could pay off. The starting lineup one seems a little strange to me. The firepower that Portland possesses, I mean, they had a top 10 offense last year. Defensively, obviously they struggle, but I see teams like Detroit and Toronto in front of them for starting lineups, and I kind of scratch my head. Like, I mean, Kyle Lowry's a good player, but he's 31, almost 32. DeMar DeRozan's a good player, but, I mean, both those guys completely disappeared in the playoffs for long stretches last season. Detroit, don't get me wrong, I'm a huge Andre Drummond fan, but Reggie Jackson, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, I mean, do we really think that those guys put a better starting lineup on the floor than Portland can this year?
Well, I mean, it depends on how much you value some of their stars, I think. But, you know, basically, it seems like this is what everybody's doing with Portland. CBS has them ranked somewhere between the top third and second third of the league. You know, better than just plain average, but not really great. And yeah, I mean, I can see where they do that. It feels to me like here's what people are doing with Portland. They're going, okay, we know this team, that team, and the other team are placed exactly here. The Blazers got to fit in the gooey middle part somewhere, so this seems like we'll put them there.
It's like they don't want to sell them short because of what they achieved last season, but they also don't want to put them too high based on one season's worth where there was, I don't know, some extenuating circumstances with injuries.
And Evan Turner and Festus Ezeli and all that stuff, right?
They're unknowns. So,
yeah, exactly. And I think this is the feedback that you're getting, is that the people are scratching their heads about the Blazers. Now, the good part about that is that Portland has tended to excel when people were scratching their heads instead of playing hard against them or believing in them or whatever. So maybe that door is open for that kind of underdog, you should have known better vibe. I'm sure that's what the Blazers will be playing.
Sure
we'll have another season of hashtag they to rely on. So maybe that'll carry him. But at the end of the year, 11th best. And keep in mind the starting lineup, not entire team. But 11th best seems about right. I mean, you could go up to 8. You could go down to 12, 13. But it's somewhere in the middle there. Now, Nate Duncan and Danny LaRue on the Dunked On podcast, they are also podcasters and national media guys. They were, what should we say, unsparing in their criticism of Portland's offseason. I believe the grade was, quote, F-. Was that, am I accurate in that?
Yeah, I mean, I had
the minus stars signed,
yeah,
or something. I don't know.
I mean, I had my reactions to the Turner signing, and that's really what they reacted to pretty heavily, both Duncan and LaRue. And I had some time in Vegas to talk to Danny, and his reaction to the Turner signing was pretty much mimicked by mine. And I think I get where he's coming from, but I don't know if it's that dire. I mean, There's bad signings, and I guess if you're just looking at the dollar amounts and how Portland appears to be locked in, and everybody's like, well, there's a consolidation trade that's happening. Well, consolidation trades, you need a trading partner, and that's kind of what they hit on a little bit. So I don't know, man. That seems pretty harsh. I mean, like I said, I had my issues with the offseason, but I didn't think it was F-minus bad. They weren't out there handing out max deals to guys that had no business getting them. So that seemed a bit much.
Yeah, I mean, people are so extreme nowadays, and we see it too, like in the reaction to the work we do. They're either in an extreme camp, it was A+ or it was F-, or they want to push you into an extreme camp because you're south or north of where they are. And it's like, you know, your summer can be a C+, C-, that actually happens. In fact, it happens for most of the league. I think the disappointment, if there is any, is not that it was an F-minus summer. It's that the Blazers had been gearing for the summer and came up with a C+, right? You don't want to take a big swing and end up there, right? That's the disappointment. But that doesn't make the summer an F. It makes it a C.
Yeah, that seems, which is kind of strange for them. because those are two guys that are incredibly in depth and well versed in what's going on around the league. So that when I saw that grade and I heard that podcast, I kind of took a step back. Like, really, guys? I mean, I know your personal reaction went from talking to Danny, but you know, if you look at each individual signing by itself, none of them are really bad. And but when you take a look at the whole, I can see where they can say financially that there's some issues, but I don't know how you can sit there and say that this is an F-minus summer when the team retained everybody it wanted to retain, and it brought in a couple new pieces that have potential in them.
Yeah, I mean, this is typical. This is how the Blazers operate nowadays. Yeah. Every move in isolation seems fine. Some are good. Some don't work out. I mean, Robin Lopez worked out well. Noah Vonleh has not worked out so far. All the moves seem fine, though. I mean, you can't really argue with them, any of them in isolation. In aggregate, it ends up, you know, except for, of course, I mean, we must throw in the caveat of drafting Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, et cetera, et cetera. We all know that story. That's A-plus material right there. You know, Alan Crabb, that's A-level material right there. But, you know, the rest of the stuff just is, you know, some great and some horrible. So, but that's not an F-minus. That's kind of swings and misses, swings and singles. It's a utility player.
They're playing money ball. I mean, it's on base percentage, right?
Well, yeah, except we still don't even have quite that. I mean, it's just the Blazers right now aren't that home run king or the all-star. They are, you know, a really good utility player, shortstop or second baseman, you know? And they've got to make more moves. They've got to do something in order to advance themselves, but they haven't gone backwards. And, you know, it's just, like I said, the critique is you hoped for more for the summer and didn't get it, but that's not an F minus. And let's move to SB Nation's own Jesus Gomez, who did a nice write-up of the Blazers, fairly long, too. And just summarizing, he said almost what we just said, that it seemed like it was a fine set of moves. They did all right, but it seemed like the Blazers missed an opportunity to do something more, which you could quibble with. Like, people say, well, what was that opportunity if Hassan Whiteside and et cetera weren't available? And I think there are two ways to take that critique or to make it. One is to say, well, it was empirically cemented that player was never going to be available, so you never had a chance at him, and that's not your fault, and la-la, you're just walking through the posies and have no effect on the world around you. Or you can say, well, Portland's position and Portland's pitch and Portland's whatever also plays into that player not being available for Portland the way he was for some other teams. So, I mean, where do you follow what Gomez says and all that?
Honestly, I think the global perspective right now among most of the national media and other media members that are out there is that the moves that Portland made in isolation were okay. Some were good, some not so good, but that seems to be the bottom line. Where everybody seems to get, you know, kind of go off course or go radical is the dollar figure. And I can get that point of view. I don't necessarily agree to the fullest extent that some of the other people that are out there, but at the same token, you kind of get where they're coming from. Now, as far as how the season or the offseason has played out so far, I kind of fall in the middle, like, of, you know, okay, yeah, the Blazers positioned themselves, and they said they've been positioning themselves for free agency, and they were going to take a home run swing, and they missed. But part of that is that those free agents may or may not have wanted to come here. Now, it definitely doesn't. It's a. I don't know if it's a black eye, but it's not a good look when you get a guy like Chandler Parsons, who's basically looks like he's done. It's a done deal. He's coming to Portland, and it turns out he's basically just leveraging Portland against Memphis to get the deal there. And that isn't a good look. And I think it's something that people haven't really talked about all that much. But I think it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Yeah, we'll do that next week. Actually, let's do that because there's a big undercurrent of, well, free agents just don't want to come to Portland because of the city. And maybe we should broach that a little bit next week. So you mentioned something in the middle of all this, and that is a consolidation trade coming. And we heard some media attention given to that. Although it was interesting to me, they said that, well, now the Blazers have the contracts to make a consolidation trade, which is kind of true in the new NBA, but unspoken in all of that. was that they probably could have made a consolidation trade last season, because if you took any three available Blazers who didn't have minimum salaries, plus their cap space available, they would have gotten pretty close to a star salary. So it's not like they couldn't have made this trade before, depending on the player and their salary. They certainly have the cap ballast to do it now, which is necessary because they're over the cap and the salaries have to match. But I'm not sure that the narrative of we signed all these players to a lot of money so we could make a consolidation trade quite holds all the water it should, and I'm not sure that trade is quite possible. What say you?
Yeah, a trade has to come. I mean, we highlighted last week, you know, the issues with the front court. And by issues, I mean the amount of bodies that are there. There's just not, there's 96 minutes to go between the two. I mean, you've got 6-7 guys that are going to play through there. I mean, that's not sustainable. So,
and,
I mean,
well, also the money that's going into the backcourt too. I mean,
yeah.
You have the balance on the other. You have $86 million or so coming to four guards. I mean, I don't care what the cap is. That's a lot of money. And so you have huge financial ballast on one side and huge talent balance problems on the other side. Yeah, it seems like this is kind of – the room needs to get cleaned up. Can they do it?
They can do it, but there's definitely going to be some roadblocks in the way. If – the thing is yeah, these you see in the comments and in feedback that, you know, all these contracts are all tradable. They're only tradable if these guys maintain or excel. If they don't maintain or if they don't excel, they don't become tradable. Then they become albatrosses. And even in today's NBA, those contracts are larger than your average role player salary. So if they do fall off in any way, shape, matter, or form, you're talking about trading them, and you're probably going to have to take something back that you don't want in return.
Well, and here's the deal. I don't know even if maintaining is enough in some cases, because fans are idealizing that this consolidation trade will not involve Damian Lillard or CJ McCollum, which the team is also certainly sending signals that way as well. They're not willing to part with those two. So you have to ask, if they just maintain, how much demand was there for Mo Harkless? Who were the Blazers bidding against? How much demand was there for Myers Leonard? How much demand was there for Evan Turner at that price point? I mean, it's not like the Blazers went out and snagged these guys away from a ton of other people who wanted them. Alan Crabb had some interest, certainly. His name would be hot in the hopper. Perhaps Al-Farouq Aminu, but Ed Davis has been on a bunch of teams and he's not stuck. And that's, I don't think that's his fault, by the way. I think I like Ed Davis a whole lot, but it's not like people are beating down the doors for him either. Mason Plumlee, maybe. I mean, the people you can make a trade with as things are right now, there's not a ton of them who are that attractive to lure a star level player.
No, and I think you have to. And I think the Blazers front office, that there's two things at play here. One, when you're talking about these guys like Leonard, Harkless, the RFAs, the league kind of sent out a memo, I think it was last year or year before, basically telling front offices to stop saying that you're going to match on contracts, because it kind of cools the RFA process. And the Blazers, I mean, it feels like for every bit that they had done that and did do that this year, and I think that may have cooled some of the interest on guys like Leonard and Harkless, Crabb particularly, even though Brooklyn did put the contract out there, they still strung him out for 3 days and made him wait. And Neil O'Shea made a point of saying, hey, we didn't do that to you, Crabb. We did that to, you know, to the Nets just to make them wait and lock up their money. The other part of this is that I think that they have a pulse kind of on what's going on around the league with any potential trade targets that they're after. I think that, I don't know if they're banking on it, but I think they're hoping, or they have a feeling that a premier level player or premier level talent is either on the last year and is either going to force a trade, or is in the second, you know, has 2 years left on a deal and force a trade, a la DeMarcus Cousins, something along those lines. I don't know if Cousins is a target, but I just have a feeling that if they're going to look at a consolidation trade, they're going to use what they have and then package it up with whatever's necessary to make the deal to bring in that guy. And I think that that's the reason that they built the way that they did.
You know, I can see it. I don't know about the, again, the demand thing. I get it if your restricted free agent is considering offers in the first week of free agency when everybody needs and wants their money. But some of these guys went pretty late. I mean, 3 days at the end of July is not the same as 3 days at the beginning of July. So, yeah, I mean, there's a little asterisk there. But the other thing is, I don't know about this trade process. At least when you have money to offer free agents, you are financially, in terms of the deal itself in isolation, on a level playing ground with everybody else, because money is money, whether it comes from Portland or whether it comes from Houston or whatever. Obviously, there's an income tax difference to get that, but you know that's the only difference between the two. Trading, you're not on a level playing field. You are only as good as the assets you can offer. First round draft picks that are going to be low, you know, they have value, I think, in terms of financially, but it's not like the Blazers are planning on having lottery picks to offer. And the players they have, well, are they going to be able to make the most attractive offer for DeMarcus Cousins if he comes up? I don't see the Blazers being any farther ahead in that field than they were in free agency. In fact, they may be behind.
Yeah, for me, that's the only thing that makes sense to me as far as, and that's how I'm kind of, that's the lens that I'm looking through this, is that Portland had to have an idea that, okay, we need to keep as many assets as we can, and if we're going to keep these assets, let's get them in at a deal that makes sense, that allows for them, if they do grow, that, I don't know, this is where I get a little bit of hesitation, is that, do you see any of these guys, with the exception of maybe Myers and Harkless, so basically Crabbe and Turner, do you see either Crabbe or Turner outperforming their contract at any point in their career?
You know, Crabbe, I think, has the potential. Turner, it's going to have to be a fit thing. And I think, by the way, I think Turner deserves money, all right? I don't think he's a bad player. I think I mentioned before, when he was back in Indiana, I had some interest in him in a package deal, and I would have been happy for the Blazers to get him, actually. But with Turner, I think that you're not going to get above that level. I think the Blazers basically maxed him out in terms of what the league would pay. The Blazers were the number one suitor. That's why they got him. However, I mean, here's a sense where you're maintaining might work, not necessarily maintaining current level, but if they can play up to that contract instead of exceeding it, just match it, then maybe that contract makes sense to trade away. The problem is there is now you've invested time in developing these players, you've actually succeeded in doing so, and now you trade those players? That's not what people are going to want to see, but that's probably what's going to have to happen if this consolidation is going to go through.
And that's where I kind of find myself at this point, is that if they're going to do this consolidation trade, it's going to require giving up a piece that you don't want to give up. And that's really the crux of an NBA trade. If you're a fan, you're looking at an NBA trade, and you feel like you've won the trade, there's about a 99% chance that trade's not going to happen. I mean, there are always trades out there that catch people off guard. But for the most part, when you look at these deals that get done, it looks like both teams either won or both teams lost.
Right, exactly.
That's typically how these trades look. And in order for that to happen, the team has to give up something that it doesn't want to give up. And in that case, and that's why I look at a guy like Crabbe, where if he outperforms, then he, to me, is the most likely one to go. Now, if you're asking me which of the players with new deals, with the exception of McCollum, is most likely to surpass the value of their contract, I go back to Leonard every time. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at that, and it's basically $10.4 million a year, I think is what the average salary is. If you look at that under the old salary cap, you're looking at like an $8.5 million deal, 8.2, something along those lines. For a center that, power forward, whatever you want to call him, that's going to play probably 22 minutes a night, that's pretty on par with what Ed Davis got paid. I mean, exactly. It's not that much more, and he's only 24 years old, and he has a skill set that's very rare in the NBA. So for his chance to outperform that contract, he could be incredibly valuable going forward.
And I think that's what you're going to see have to happen, is that, first of all of a sudden you're going to remember, oh yeah, the Blazers have Ed Davis after whatever trade goes down, if a trade goes down. Like, oh, okay, this is why we kept Ed, even though he hasn't played big minutes for a long time, because he can play, right? And the front office will sell it as, look, we had this draft pick 5 years ago, all right, and it was a lower lottery pick, and now we've turned it into what was an upper lottery pick 5 years ago. Now we've turned it into Marcus Cousins or some veteran star or whatever. So that would all make sense if it happens. But let's close this portion of the conversation on this. I will tell you what's also in the Blazers, like, you know, promotional lexicon. They're very good at mentioning the possibilities of things that could happen, less so at coming through with them. In other words, you get like, oh yes, we've developed cap flexibility so we can play the free agent market this summer. Okay, yes, we all understand that's why you did that, but what really counts is how you play the market. We all understand that there is a potential for a trade now with these contracts. We get that. What matters is what the trade is and if it happens. That's what you're judged on, not your ability to create possibilities, because almost every team that isn't brain dead can do that. It's the actual execution of the move, and we need to see that in order to judge whether these things were successful or not. Now let's go on. We want to hat tip Timmy, who has been running for a couple weeks now a set of anniversary posts. It is our 10th year anniversary coming up, my 10th year anniversary anyway, in August. And so let's lighten up a little bit and talk about a couple of categories that he may have mentioned, a couple that he may not yet. First of all, let's just start real easy, Dan. You Blazer follower forever, who's your favorite Blazer of all time, of any era, doesn't matter when, who's your guy?
I vacillate between Sabas and Roy. Sabas was a guy that I ran into one of my younger years quite often, and I was so starstruck by him. He spent a lot of time in the Beaverton area, apparently, because I swear to God, I ran into that guy from the time he got here in 96 till he left. I probably ran into him like 30 times. Always the kindest, gentlest, nicest guy. Posed for pictures, signed autographs, chatted my family up. I mean, just amazing. This is all the off the court stuff. Then you look at the on the court stuff and how truly unique of a player he was. It was, I mean, a behemoth of a man doing things nobody that big should ever be able to do. And then for me, the reason I go back to Roy, when I left the armed forces and came home, it was Roy's rookie year. I, through pomp and circumstances, found a contest to design Roy's Rookie of the Year video contest on the Trailblazers website. I ended up winning the contest, and the end of the I had a press pass to sit on the end of the bench for the last game of the regular season during his rookie year, and I got to sit there and watch a game and talk to Prisbilla wasn't dressed that night, so I had Pris on my left, and for the most part Roy on my right. And it was a game where Outlaw I think ended up going for like 36, but both those guys, just being able to watch a game and talk to them about what was going on the court and see what was going on, this transformation of Portland, getting out of the Jailblazers days. Thankfully, this is the one time I can say I was thankful I was in Iraq and Afghanistan, because I didn't have to deal with the Jailblazers. So that's kind of a weird circumstance, but I kind of got to come back to civilian life, come back to reality, and embrace the change that Brandon Roy helped bring this organization. And again, as a basketball player, what he could do and the way he dictated games was something I had never seen before. I mean, it was so unique and so just tantalizing. You couldn't turn off a Blazers game if Brandon Roy was in it. And it was unbelievable. So I go back and forth between those guys. And there's some older guys that I love and I cherish, but those are the two guys I go to every time.
I think I had the most fun ever watching Clyde Drexler. I doubt he'll ever be supplanted just because of the time when he came along in my life. It was the right time, right player. Obviously, the finals trips, so you have quality unmatched by anyone except for Bill Walton and Maurice Lucas, you know. So Drexler probably still holds the number one overall, but I agree with you, and we can transition into the Blazers' edge era in the last 10 years now, that it started with the best. Brandon Roy was phenomenal. I remember watching him the first time I went to cover Summer League, and just instantly noticing his four-directional ability to move with the ball. I mean, because the rap on Roy coming out was that he was NBA ready, but he wasn't really an athlete. You know, he wasn't like that dominant player.
I love that.
Then you watch him move and watch defenders go, oh, crap, he's past me, and I didn't even know that he was moving. And it wasn't because of blazing quickness. He wasn't a Tyronn Lue or anything like that. He was just crafty. He was smart. And he had this thing that you couldn't define, where if he needed space, any direction that space appeared, he would take it, and then he would take the shot in it, and that shot was probably going to be pretty good. And I think people kind of downplay it because you remember the injuries, the amnesty clause or whatever, but when Brandon Roy was good, Brandon Roy was really, really dang good.
I've had this argument a couple times, and normally it ends up coming back with people going, you know what, you're right. And at peak, Brandon Roy was a top five player in the NBA. Peak Brandon Roy was nearly unstoppable. And the argument everybody always has, well, you're talking about LeBron and KD, and Kobe was still good, and Wade was there. When you've got guys like Kobe Bryant and Ron Artest saying that you're the toughest cover they've ever had to deal with, the most gifted player they've ever had to deal with, that speaks volumes of how good a player that he was. And some people will argue the top five argument, but watching Brandon Roy take over a game was, I don't know, it was like transcendence for me. I just get just mesmerized by it. And it was just, it was crazy.
And the dude was playing with LaMarcus Aldridge too, who was not shabby on his own. And so he had to work in LaMarcus and keep him satisfied too, which for the most part he seemed to do. But it wasn't like this guy was just given carte blanche immediately. When he was a rookie, by the way, he played with Zach Randolph too, and Randolph was the big dog.
Yeah, that was actually Zach's team then.
Yeah, it was. So, yeah, it's not like he got the free pass, we're not going anywhere, so score all you want ticket. He was a legit basketball player from the jump. So I guess we agree, there's us agreeing, Ian, our favorite player of the Blazers' Edge era. Who do you think the most underrated player of the Blazers' Edge era was? The guy that fans probably made too little of compared to his contributions, production, or whatever.
Folklore-wise, I'm tempted to say Pris Bella. Everybody loved him for his grit and his toughness. But to me, he was the guy that kept the team together for a long, long time. He was one constant that would be there. He wasn't the spectacular player, but he provided the team everything that they needed from that position. Grit, toughness, screen setting, rebounding, a little bit of nasty. To me, he was that guy. And the Blazers have had so many guys that were tagged with potential. Bayless, Outlaw, Martell. Sergio was a guy that and Rudy both had so much potential, and then the Spanish Armada sank pretty quick.
You had to be here to understand the hype that was going on. I mean, we had the I'd rather have Jarrett Jack and Martell Webster than Chris Paul anyway. And then we had the Spanish Armada come in, and we had Travis Outlaw is going to turn out to be a superstar. And all of that was like percolating all at once, along with Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge. And then Greg Oden. I mean, and that was legit, by the way. That once they got Oden, the hype, that was
legit, real hype
right there. That was ready to go. But the absolute public pressure of excitement in that little 2-year span. Free Bayless. I mean, that came from Blazers Edge. Ben Golliver started it, you know. Free Bayless in there, too. It's like everybody on the Blazers seemed to have unbounded, unlimited potential, and everybody was just waiting to see how it was going to shake out.
So that's what makes me think that the guys that played to what they needed to do. So for me, it's Prisbilla and probably number two, Andre Miller.
Ah, yeah, that's an interesting choice. I'd say, yeah, Andre did more things than he got credit for.
Mm-hmm.
For me, though, I think I have to go with Aldridge. I think that he spent the first couple years of his career playing second fiddle to Roy. When he got out of Roy's shadows because of injury, people spent a season or so speculating he was too soft, not liking him going out of the post, not saying he wasn't going to be good enough or he was going to be good but not great. Then he had about maybe 12 to 18 months of really getting credit for what he did, and then he got skewered as he left. So, I mean, most of his tenure in Portland...
He was criminally underrated.
Yeah, low level grumpiness with him, or just being shish kebab. And, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge is and was an absolutely legit talent. Had Brandon Roy not been drafted that year, had that been LaMarcus Aldridge's summer league, the Blazer fans would have pinned so much on him. And then Greg Oden, of course, the year afterwards, kind of overshadowed the front court. And Aldridge always was the more fluid, in many ways the more athletic. He wasn't as strong, he didn't have as much raw power as Oden did, but he was the more the basketball player, the guy who looked like he was going to come in and take care of business. And he even outshined Roy in some ways, although Roy obviously had a better outing and got to control the ball, which helped him. But if you just look at combination of athleticism and basketball player, Aldridge was just about everything that you'd want and never got the credit for it.
He's probably the most criminally underrated number two overall pick probably ever. I mean, he, by all counts and measures, should have been the number one overall pick, and not just in a redraft. Let's just say Colangelo doesn't lose his mind and take Bargnani first. I mean, that people forget that coming out of Texas, that LaMarcus was the Big 12 player of the year. He was a Wooden Award finalist. I mean, he was a legit player. And everybody was really surprised when Barks went number one. So I can't think of a time where a higher draft pick had less placed on him right out of the chute. I mean, number two overall pick. I mean, that's crazy.
You'd think he was going to be the instant star, and people just never thought of him that way. All right, how about the most overrated player of the last 10 years? The guy that people just got behind too much, made too much of.
Oh, God, I'm tempted to go with Felton, but nobody ever got behind him.
He had enough junk behind him already. Although, you know, he may be underrated in terms of he's vilified. I'm not saying he had a good season, but how he was used as a standstill point guard, feeding LaMarcus Aldridge in the post and then receiving the ball back to shoot standstill three-pointers, that is so not his game.
Yeah.
And he played it, you know, so, hey, I mean, I was not happy with Felton being out of shape. I was not happy with his quotes. I was not happy with his play. But he wasn't in the ideal situation either.
Most overrated, though, I'm going to have to go with Trout. Trout's the dude. And I love Trout. But nobody was given more chances than him. Every year, this is going to be his year. Every year, this is going to be his year. Nick Batum, after his third year, people were like, is he ever going to figure this out? Trout's in his fifth year, and everybody's like, oh, no, he'll figure this out eventually. He'll get it. He'll get it. It's like, you know, he's been through four NBA teams after he's left the Blazers, and people were like, you know what? I still think he'll figure it out. I'm just like, guys, he's not gonna do it. He's just not gonna figure it out. And Travis ended up becoming a decent role player here or there for a couple years, but man, the hype coming out concerning him, and he's gonna be this, he's gonna be that, he's the sixth man, he's the starter. It got to the point where I was just like, can we just let the guy play ball?
Yeah, but you know what? take me back there, and I'll happily go through that again. give me that team back. With
oh, that team is entertaining. There's no doubt about it.
I'll pick up the Bomb Bombs. I mean, we were always mixed, like, enthusiastic yet skeptical about Outlaw, you know, obviously potential versus production. But there was a certain rootability for that player and that team that hasn't necessarily been duplicated since.
It hasn't died.
But, you know, I guess my most overrated player would have to be coming back to the league playing for Philly. Sergio Rodriguez. I mean, Rudy Fernandez might have been a close second. The hype for those two was so huge. But Rodriguez, of course, had a couple good moves, could pass like nobody's business. But he was only getting very few minutes on the court. And this was really my first blush with, I was explaining to people why he was not playing more. And they were explaining to me how I'm biased and know nothing and I'm super negative and what have you. Simply because, I mean, the guy didn't have defense. His offense was spotty if he couldn't pass. Opponents were playing him specifically for the pass, daring him to shoot or to score, and he could not make them pay. And so it was pretty clear why he couldn't play more at that point. And people were up in arms because they loved the guy, and for good reason in some ways. But it was just interesting to see him traded and moved on and then out of the league back in Spain. I hope he has – I'm interested to see what he does this year because a more mature, more developed Sergio Rodriguez might be kind of scary. I would like to see him do it. But to me, that was my first blush with people really getting on a bandwagon and taking it too far.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to hop on that bandwagon real quick because if we're talking about the totality of Sergio Rodriguez in Portland, okay, I get that argument. But that first year, I don't care what you say. Give me that. Give me that. Give me that. Give me that. I mean, my family had season tickets. Has had season tickets now for God knows how long. And going to those games when those two came out on the court together – The thing was, you said it exactly right. They played him for the pass, and he still threw a bounce pass through their legs to a back-cutting Rudy Fernandez for a dunk. And that's what was just like, I don't care about the metrics in that case. I just don't. The guy was a passing maestro. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I knocked Damian Lillard for almost nothing save defense, but the fact that he can't throw a lob, I trace that back to Sergio Rodriguez because he threw so many lobs. It was just Sergio threw more lobs, I guarantee, in his first 6 months in the NBA than Damian Lillard has thrown in his career.
Yeah, I mean,
That's not hyperbole. I'll go and see if I can find the stat afterwards because I almost guarantee that that's a fact.
And when Sergio and Rudy got the rare opportunity to get going for a couple plays, even. It was pretty. I mean, that was nice.
Now, the garden caught fire.
Yeah. The opponent had to be a little bit asleep. And obviously, you didn't want to look at what was happening on the other end when those two were on the floor. But I get the excitement. I totally do. At the same time, when reality doesn't live up to that excitement, what do you do? And a lot of people were invested at that time blaming the coach. And, you know, blaming Roy at some point.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, no, that Brandon is legitimately a better player by several orders of degree than either of those two. And as much as we like them, they're probably not NBA ready yet. I would be fascinated, though, to see what would have happened if Rudy and Sergio could have hopped in a time machine and zapped forward to, say, 2015 or 2014, and had come into the league as young, you know, players then, I think that they might have had more of an impact and more of a good time.
Well, playing in this style of NBA and then also Rudy not being undercut by Trevor Ariza, of which I still hold a serious grudge against Trevor Ariza for.
I mean, this is the thing, though. I mean, we've kind of brought this up before, but it bears repeating. There are layers to getting great in this game, and there will be layers for the current Trailblazers. And what Sergio and Rudy found out was, like, learning how to operate in this league and run the plays and score and whatever, that's just the very basic kindergarten layer. if you start getting good, people are going to clock you upside the head, undercut you, rib you, try to do anything they can to get you off your game. And you got to deal with that, too. That's like layer two, not to mention the increased defense and double teams and stuff like that.
Schemes built around you.
Yeah. So, like, it's really funny because it seems like, I'll tell you, we're packing our house right now. We're making a move. And
you're finding layers?
Yes, you do, don't you? Because it looks, you look, okay, I got like five rooms left to pack. Okay, I can see the end from here. Except what you don't understand is how many drawers, how many cupboards, how many knickknacks, how many whatevers that you have to go through. And each room is like its own evolution, its own adventure. That's exactly the way it is trying to get from first 20 wins to 40 wins in the NBA, but then from 40 to 50. And then there's a lot of layers in between 50 and 60. And you better be able to deal with anything and everything if you plan to get to the level that San Antonio has gotten to, that even Oklahoma City got to. I mean, the difference between those teams and the pretty good Trailblazers is much more than wins and losses.
Yeah, no, I just didn't think we were going to go for the Shrek analogy. You know, Blazers are like, or NBA players are like onions.
Yes, I like onions. And they make you cry sometimes. So let's wrap it up, speaking of Oklahoma City, with the topic we brought up last week a little bit. Let's go a little bit more in depth, but we have to move kind of quickly. The Northwest Division is packed.
Mm-hmm.
May not be the best division empirically in the NBA, but I think it's the tightest division.
It's going to be a dogfight.
Top to bottom, the distinction between the five teams, now that Kevin Durant is in a different division, is going to be anybody's guess. It's going to be negligible. So how do you have let's figure this out. How do we have our divisions ranked and why? Who do you have at number one in the Northwest Division and why?
I've got Utah number one, and before everybody boos and hisses, I think that team is, every year there's a team that's primed to make a run. Portland ended up being that team last year and avoided the injury bug. Utah was the exact opposite. Utah was one game out of the playoffs when they missed the entire season from their, you know, young point guard in Dante Exum. Favors and Gobert were both beat up through most of the season. I mean, that team was just beat up. That's what it comes down to. Watching Lyles' progression, adding Joe Johnson and Boris Diaw, they have 2 5-man units that are very good. They play some of the best defense in the league. Gordon Hayward is on the border of a 20.5 rebound, 5 assist kind of player. The same kind of stat lines that Brandon Roy used to put up all the time. I know it's heresy to mention Gordon Hayward equals Brandon Roy. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying his contributions are on the same level.
Yeah, I hate watching Gordon Hayward. I'm sorry. I got to confess. I don't have many prejudices in this league, but watching Gordon Hayward is one of them. I don't know why he just...
It's his hair, isn't it?
That's me the wrong
it's
way.
The
oh,
fact
yeah.
that his hair doesn't
it's
move.
Perfect. That's right.
I do have Portland a close second, though. I mean, we're talking probably 1 to 2 game separation if there's going to be some. Then again, we're also talking ESPN.com in their preseason predictions have Portland number 4 in the West, Utah number 5. Okay, so like I'm not just spitballing here. This is what other teams or other media outlets are stating the same.
Be unique, Dan Morang.
Yeah,
it's okay. You say it.
They had Portland 4. They had 5 Utah. So I'm going Utah. Yeah. I'm going Utah for that 4 seed. That's the way I think it's going to pan out. I've been pretty consistent saying that I think Portland's going to finish somewhere in the 5 to 7 range. So Portland's number 2 in the division, and then OKC and then Denver and Minnesota. Now, Minnesota can go one of two ways. They can continue down the path of incremental growth and maybe win 35, 36 games, or Andrew Wiggins figures out a jump shot and Chris Dunn ignites their second unit and they have a legitimate shooting threat on the floor. And Cat continues his, you know, absolute pulverization of the NBA. And they become a 41-42 win team. Now, I already think Portland going into Minnesota gave Portland problems last year. They got better. So going into Minnesota, the thing is about it, like Denver, Minnesota, You know, those, and even Utah to an extent, were places, Portland over the last couple of years comfortably said, we can go in there and get a win. That's not so much so anymore.
Right.
So
I'm close to you. I also have Utah as number one just because, look, I think last year the playoffs were the bar and Portland was poised and running to jump it, and they did. This year, I think Portland's performance is the bar for the division, if not for the Western Conference non-top three. I mean, I think everybody's gunning for Portland, and the Blazers are going to be the hurdle. I think Utah is one of the teams with potential to jump it and momentum to jump it. Mm-hmm. And I see them with more momentum than I see the Blazers, even though the hurdle is farther ahead than the runner right now as we speak. So I have Utah there. I'm a little worried about OKC. If Durant were there, as we talked about, they'd be clear number one. But yeah, they still got Russell Westbrook. I like Oladipo. I like what they're going to be able to do defensively, I think. And you know, I'm not sure that they've tapped the potential on some of their players, not just the new ones either. So I, what happens to Steven Adams? You know,
the Adamses and the Cantors.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're legit scary, and it wouldn't surprise me to see them edge out the Blazers by a game or win the tiebreaker. So I'm going to be different and put OKC there. I think Portland's number three, but with the caveat that any of those three can go any direction. If it was Portland number one, Utah, OKC,
those
or Portland,
are the three
OKC,
that are
Utah.
For the division title.
Yeah, either way, you can pretty much put them in a jar and pull out a name. So I'll go Utah, OKC, Portland, just because I think OKC is being underrated, and I think Utah has a lot of momentum. I've got Minnesota next, just because I think they also have a ton of momentum, and Carl Anthony Towns, I mean, his second year, he knows what's going on now. He has the potential to be an unstoppable force. People were already making the argument, would you rather have him or Anthony Davis? And at the beginning of last season, people were saying, if I could have any player in the world, it would be Anthony Davis. So that tells you what Kat's done. And I think that, and then coaching, of course, Thibodeau, it's going to be a big deal. And there's big potential there. Whether they'll get it in year one remains to be seen. Whether there are more moves to make remains to be seen. But, oh, boy, I mean, they could be a problem. I don't have them passing Portland yet. But, you know, if someone's going to sneak up, like, big time, it's going to be the Wolves. And then Denver is last, not because they're as bad as they were, but just because it's hard to cure crazy. And you know, I'll believe it from Denver when I see it. That said, they're not an easy out either. And really, with just a little bit of head tilting and squinting, you could mix up all five of the teams in this division and put them in almost any order and have a credible argument. Not quite, but you're pretty close.
I mean, they're one injury away. I mean, if OKC loses Westbrook for any substantial period of time, they're at the bottom of the barrel. Yeah. I mean, Lillard or CJ goes down for any serious amount of time, they could seriously falter. Utah's probably the one team you can't say a one injury would affect, but a ton of injuries like they had last year, yeah, they'll fall apart.
Sure, Portland's more bulletproof, though. Portland needs more. I mean, yes, Damian Lillard, I get it. If it's months and months, of course.
Yeah, we're talking substantial injuries.
But
yeah.
I think that the Blazers could do without Lillard for a week and be all right.
I think
they're better off, yeah. And they're better off than they were last year. So they're certainly deeper in that way, in that they have more redundancy. So, you know, you'd hope. I mean, if Lillard went down, I assume you'd slide McCollum to point guard and then Turner to shooting guard.
Yep.
And you call that a fairly decent backcourt. So, I mean, hey, kudos to the Blazers for that. And that's why I think that, you know, that they can be mentioned in the same breath with anyone in the division. And you can, as you said, put them in the fourth seed without blinking, because more things have to go wrong this year to take them out of it.
Yeah, I think, honestly, that those top three teams in the division are, like you said, you can kind of mix and match where they're going to be, and it's probably going to be within, I mean, ESPN had it as those three teams separated by two games, so one game apiece between them all.
Which means, by the way, and we should preview this, every game in the division
matters.
Is going to count. I mean, you're talking tiebreakers in November.
And that's what I was getting to, is that those bottom two teams while they may not make the playoffs, they may shape the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Because if Minnesota or Denver come into Portland and steal a home game, or manage to win a series against one of these teams, which is statistically more than likely, that could seriously alter the way that this division breaks out. And remember, the NBA still hasn't gotten rid of the division winner rule. So that will break down or change how the seedings in the playoffs break out.
Well, and can you imagine heading into April being maybe 2 to 3 games ahead of Minnesota, but Minnesota owns the tiebreaker because of stuff that happened in December?
Yep.
That's a possibility. I would assume the Blazers wouldn't be behind them, but you wouldn't be real comfortable heading into the last month only a couple games ahead and knowing you lose in a tie situation. I mean, So this is going, that more than anything else is going to make this season crazy. If you widen out to the conference, okay. Again, tapping or breaking the top three is going to be a major surprise if Portland does it. So that's not as exciting. And really arguing about, well, am I the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th seed? That's less exciting. But winning this division is going to be where the money's at and where the fun's at in 2016-17.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where This is the storyline that I think I'm most excited from a kind of a 10,000 feet perspective, is how does this division shake out? Because there's a lot of youth, there's a lot of room for growth, and there's a lot of really interesting storylines. And every single team, and even the Denvers of the world, where they only get 6,000 people to show up for a game, they've got some really fun and interesting players. Watching them down at Summer League, that team is loaded with young players that either or will kind of make or break which way the franchise goes over the next couple of years. Same can be said of Minnesota. So I'm really excited for that.
Yep, and we will be following it every step of the way with you. We've got to call it quits for right now, but we will see you again next week. And for Dan Marang, this is Dave Deckard, hoping your summer is going well, and thank you for listening to the Blazers Edge podcast.